Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. I'm Jim Tedder. Jill Robbins joins us today to teach us English and then inform us about some special satellites that are designed to help developing countries. We have a lot of work to do, so let's hear first about some unusual but important words that we all need to know. Jill?
One fish, two fish, red fish, blue fish, goes the Dr. Seuss children's story. Why isn't it two fishes? You may think,
okay, it's hard to count fish, so we group them all together. No problem.
It's easy to understand that farmers would not worry about making plurals when they talk about sheep. After all, they are almost always in a group. When you have one sheep, you can also call it a ram or a ewe, and make those nouns plural by adding an S, rams and ewes. Let's look at some other things we can make plural. You've got a left foot and a right foot. Put them together, and what have you got? 2 feet. That doesn't follow the add an S rule either. Same with mouse, and it's plural, mice. What happened to our neat rule for making words plural? The answer is in our history. English came from German roots. German grammar changes the vowel sound in the middle of the word to show it is plural. The plural form of the German word for goose, Gans, is Gänse. The vowel with 2 dots over it is called an umlaut, so goose becomes geese in English. There are other plurals where the vowel changes, like in the German pattern. Man, men, and woman, women are examples of different vowel sounds in plural words. Sometimes a consonant changes, as with words that end in an F sound, such as leaf. The voiceless sound F takes on a voiced quality, or V, and an S sound is added to the word. We have autumn leaves and sharp knives. Another way to make plurals in English is to add the suffix en or n. We see this in the words brother, brethren, child, children, and ox, oxen. These are words that come from Old English. With words that come from foreign languages, there are some patterns that may help you remember the plural. Many technical words in English came from Latin. Let's look at the plural of some words from Latin. Words that end in US drop that ending and add I to become plural, as in fungus, fungi, and cactus, cacti. Listen to this conversation. What is that orange thing in the tree?
It's a fungus. There are a lot of different fungi in the forest.
For words that end in UM, the ending changes to A, as in the words datum, data, and medium, media. These two words are more common in their plural forms than the singular forms in our digital life. Listen to how the words medium and media appear in this conversation. I heard you got a job at the New York Times.
Yeah, I'm glad to be working in mass media.
But newspapers are a dying medium, aren't they?
Hey, I hope not. I'm writing a blog for them.
When a word from Latin ends in EX or IX, the plural ending is ICES. This results in index, indices, and matrix, matrices. Here's another conversation. The financial news is bad. The Dow Jones index is down.
Don't worry, there are other indices, like employment, going up.
Are you ready to try making plurals with some English words? Use the Germanic pattern for these words.
Tooth.
Is your answer teeth?
Wolf.
Is your answer wolves? Use the Latin pattern for these words.
Memorandum.
Your answer should be memoranda.
Focus.
Your answer should be foci. There are many more irregular plural forms in English. We'll look at those in another episode of Everyday Grammar.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Satellite technology is the newest tool for helping developing countries deal with climate change and natural disasters. Satellites can measure conditions on the ground and share the data with communities. A partnership between the National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the U.S. Agency for International Development has invented such a system called SERVIR. Once again, here's Jill.
SERVIR captures images and environmental data, like dangerous weather and changes in water resource use. Scientists feed that information into complex computer programs. The results of the analysis are shared with people living in the affected areas, as well as governments and organizations, to help them react and prepare. Dan Irwin is the director of the NASA SERVIR Coordination Office. He told VOA Learning English that the SERVIR project shares important information with countries all over the world.
So the main goal of SERVIR really is taking space-based information and making it available to people around the world so they can really address issues that they have in their countries, whether it be deforestation, air quality, and bringing it down to village and making it available to people for better decision-making. We need to be able to convert that data to address the cares and concerns that countries have around the world. And as NASA, we can work with countries, but it's then how do we take it even further? How do we go from space to country, down to state or provincial level, down to the village level?
Jennifer Frankel Reed is the Senior Climate Change Specialist for USAID. She explained how SERVIR has helped warn Bangladeshis of flooding and prevented people in El Salvador from eating unsafe seafood. In Kenya, which depends heavily on tea farming, farmers have avoided losing crops to rising temperatures.
The idea is that through our local partnerships with hubs, we can bring that data, analyze it in ways that people can use, translate it into easy-to-use formats, and then help people with the decisions that those data inform.
Developed in 2004, SERVIR brought together the U.S. agencies with the World Bank and Central American Commission on Environment and Development. The first hub was established in Panama in 2005. But was closed in 2011. Other hubs were established in Kenya, Nepal, and Thailand between 2008 and 2014. Both Mr. Irwin and Ms. Frankel Reed said the project's goal was to empower people with information to help them grow.
We hope to continue to expand, but ultimately and absolutely the most important thing about Servier is enabling amazing people around the world.
The project now operates in more than 30 countries. I'm Jill Robbins.
This is VOA, the voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Experts are urging Cambodian farmers to diversify their crops. Most farmers in Cambodia grow rice. Many also may grow cassava and maize. But very few farmers in the country grow other vegetables. And more Cambodians are demanding organic produce. Sam Shan Tha is an organic vegetable farmer in Cambodia's Kampong Speu province. Her vegetables are pesticide-free. Depending on the season, she grows spinach, cauliflower, lettuce, or collard greens on her 6-hectare plot of land. She says farmers earn money growing vegetables instead of rice. She also says locally grown vegetables taste much better than imported vegetables. Vegetables can be sold for a higher price than rice, and it takes only 1.5 months to yield, then it is ready to harvest, while paddy rice takes 6 months to yield, Sam Shan Tha said. A recent study from the World Bank shows strong growth in Cambodia's agriculture industry. This has helped reduce the number of people in poverty from 7 million in 2007 to 3 million in 2012. Part of this growth has come from increased land cultivation for rice farming. But growth has slowed in the past 2 years. The World Bank says farmers need to increase their yield and grow more kinds of crops, such as vegetables. The bank says vegetables earn average returns of $1,575 per hectare for small farmers. This compares to $544 per hectare of cassava and only $307 per hectare of rice. Shan Sopal is the director of the Center for Policy Studies for Cambodia Development. He says it will be difficult for farmers to change crops. Many of them may lack the skills, technology, and investment money to grow vegetables. Most vegetables sold in Cambodia are imported from Vietnam and Thailand. The local competition means that there are no quick gains for Cambodian farmers. You don't have the time for learning and trials. The poor can't do that, Shan Sopal said. If they lose a crop, they lose a lot. They will be in debt. However, Mr. Sopal says that support from the government and private investment could help improve the situation. That support would also help farmers get more of the training they need. We can hopefully increase our production to the level where prices are brought down, so products like vegetables that are good for people's health are more affordable, he said. The Cambodian Center for Study and Development in Agriculture supports Cambodian farmers with training. The center also provides growers with a connection to the market. It has 8 organic food stores in Phnom Penh, as well as farmers' markets held in rural areas. The center's president, Yang Siang Koma, says Cambodia is seeing more demand for organic vegetables. The demand is greater than local farmers can supply. Farmer Yun Chem switched from growing rice to organic vegetables 8 years ago. He says he believes Cambodian consumers are choosing organic vegetables more and more, even though they are more costly. I'm Jonathan Evans.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. In the middle of the 1850s, the United States was again struggling with the issue of slavery. The dispute centered increasingly on Kansas, a territory in the middle of the country. In Kansas, white men were able to vote on whether they wanted slavery to be legal in the territory. Many Kansas settlers opposed slavery. Some of the settlers were Northern abolitionists. They believed that owning another person was immoral. Many farmers also opposed legalizing slavery. They did not want to compete with slave labor. But many people in the nearby state of Missouri wanted Kansas to permit slavery. Slavery was legal in Missouri, and many Missouri slave owners wanted to live next to a territory where slavery was legal. So when Kansas held elections, pro-slavery men from Missouri crossed the border and voted illegally. Yet their votes were accepted.
The result of the territorial elections is that you have a territorial legislature that is overwhelmingly pro-slavery. It will write a slave code for Kansas. It will say Kansas is a slave territory. Slavery is protected here.
Nicole Etchison is a historian. She says the newly elected Kansas legislature created strong laws to protect slavery in the territory. The laws said no Kansan could speak or write against slavery. And they said people who tried to help slaves escape could be put in jail or executed. The lawmakers also demanded that President Franklin Pierce dismiss the territory's governor who opposed slavery. The president agreed. He appointed a pro-slavery governor instead. Anti-slavery settlers in Kansas grew angry. They felt they could not get fair treatment from the president or the new governor. They said pro-slavery groups cheated to control the elections. So the anti-slavery settlers took an extreme step. They formed their own government. Their political group was known as the Free State Party. Its members wrote their own constitution. They also chose their own governor. Historian Nicole Etchison says Free State members refused to recognize the bogus authority of the official Kansas legislature.
That is the argument that the Free State political movement will make. Not so much that slavery is an awful thing, although some of them make that argument, but that free white settlers in Kansas have had their political rights at the ballot box denied.
President Pierce said the actions of the Free State Party seemed revolutionary. He said that if party members attacked any government property or official, party leaders should be charged with treason. Pierce gave the pro-slavery governor of Kansas control of troops at two army bases in the territory. The situation threatened to turn violent at any time. In November 1855, a pro-slavery man killed a Free State man in a dispute over land claims. To answer the attack, Free State settlers threatened the killer and burned his house. At the same time, hundreds of pro-slavery men crossed the border from Missouri. They planned to burn the town of Lawrence, where many Free State members lived. The pro-slavery governor and the Free State governor agreed to hold an emergency meeting. They negotiated a settlement, and the men from Missouri went home. But the truce did not last long. In the weeks that followed, a pro-slavery sheriff attempted to arrest the leaders of the Free State government, but failed. A few days later, the law enforcement official was shot. Around the same time, a pro-slavery grand jury found several Free State leaders guilty of treason. The grand jury also said the town of Lawrence was supporting illegal newspapers and a hotel that stored weapons. Pro-slavery officials moved to take control of the town. The wounded sheriff urged private citizens to help. Once again, hundreds of men, including many from Missouri, gathered in Kansas. Once again, the target was Lawrence. This time, however, there was no truce. On May 21, 1856, a group of pro-slavery men marched into the town. Historian David Potter describes the incident in his book, The Impending Crisis. He says the mob entered Lawrence with flags and flying banners as if it were a victorious army. Some men threw two newspaper printing presses into the river. Others freed as much alcohol as they could find. And Potter writes, the group turned five cannons on the Free State Hotel. The mob fired the cannons at the hotel and burned the house where the Free State governor lived. But no anti-slavery settlers were killed. The only person killed was a pro-slavery man. He died when part of the Free State Hotel fell on him. Anti-slavery newspapers called the attack the Sack of Lawrence. In other words, they suggested that pro-slavery raiders had completely destroyed the town. A settler named John Brown heard about the attack on Lawrence. Brown was from the eastern state of Connecticut, but he had recently moved to Kansas. He strongly opposed slavery. He also thought the Free State government was too weak. So John Brown persuaded four of his sons, his son-in-law, and two other men to answer the Sack of Lawrence. Brown believed that the battle against the forces of slavery must continue, and he believed that God had chosen him to lead it. Late at night, Brown and the other men went to a settlement near Pottawatomie Creek. They went to three homes and seized five pro-slavery men.
Took these men out of their beds, defenseless, unarmed, and hacked them to death with broadswords.
Historian Nicole Etchison explains that Brown's group seized the men, murdered them, and left their bodies next to the creek. The event became known as the Pottawatomie Massacre. The combination of the Sack of Lawrence and the Pottawatomie Massacre frightened both pro- and anti-slavery forces. Both sides believed they could be attacked at any time. They began collecting weapons to defend themselves. In the summer and autumn of 1856, the competing forces repeatedly threatened each other. They forced each other off land. They burned each other's houses. More people were killed. The territory became known as Bleeding Kansas. Nicole Etchison says the term Bleeding Kansas was evocative. In other words, it made people feel strongly.
The term is so evocative because it's a propaganda term.
Ms. Etchison says that many people, especially in the North, were against slavery in the territory. These individuals used the term Bleeding Kansas in their newspapers to gain support for their cause. The Kansas-Nebraska Act and the violence that followed also gave birth to a new political party. Its members called themselves Republicans. The Republican Party was an unusual combination of groups. It included former Democrats who were angry that their party had supported the Kansas-Nebraska Act. They believed the Democrats were allowing slavery to expand. The Republicans also included members of the old Whig Party. The Whig Party had lost badly in the elections of 1852 because its members could not agree on whether slavery should be legal. Anti-slavery Whigs found a new home in the Republican Party. The Republican Party of the 1850s also included voters who did not support immigrants, especially Irish Catholics. These nativist Republicans wanted to protect the rights of American Protestants. All Republicans were united, however, in their opposition to slavery in the Kansas and Nebraska territories. Some Republicans were abolitionists. They wanted to ban slavery everywhere in the United States. But the majority of Republicans had no interest in ending slave labor in the South. They simply did not want slavery to spread to other areas. Nicole Etchison says that white Southerners did not respond well to the new party. They believed that all Republicans were like John Brown, the anti-slavery settler who had murdered five pro-slavery men.
White Southerners do not see the distinction between a Republican Party that says, we don't like slavery, it's immoral, it shouldn't expand, and a John Brown who says, I don't like slavery, it's immoral, and it ought to be overturned by violence.
In 1854, some Republicans from the state of Illinois asked a politician named Abraham Lincoln to serve on their committee. Lincoln refused. He did not like slavery, but he still supported the Whig Party. 2 years later, in 1856, the Republicans nominated a presidential candidate for the first time. He was John C. Fremont. Fremont had explored the American West. He had been a senator from California. He was young and exciting. Republicans thought he was the right man to lead their young and exciting party. What happened to John Fremont and the election of 1856 will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.